Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Two guys drove to work. Neither guy wore a seatbelt. One guy got a ticket. One guy didn't. The same two guys drove home. One guy wore a seatbelt. One guy didn't. One guy made it home. The guy not wearing his seatbelt didn't. Don't risk it. Click it or ticket. Paid for by NHTSA.
Sergeant and Mrs. Smith, you are going to love this house.
Is that a tub in the kitchen?
There's no field manual for finding the right home. But when you do, USAA Homeowners Insurance can help protect it the right way. Restrictions apply.
It is the Anfield Wrap, and this season we are delighted to be partnering with Greene King Sport. For them and us, football is more than a game. Greene King Sport venues are shown every single Liverpool fixture that's televised across the 23-24 season. Time moves on, you get confused. And there are more than 900 sports pubs across the UK. So it doesn't matter where you're based, you can catch every minute of the action. And as you know, at the Anfield Wrap, we very much do think that the best way to watch football is with other humans. Only 3,000 of us can clamber the stairs at St James's Park. So if you want to watch it with friends, the next best place may well be a Greene King pub. Thank you very much to them for partnering with us. In front of me, I've got Josh Sexton, I've got Mo Stewart, and I've got Stu Wright to talk predominantly about Liverpool 3, Bournemouth 1. Marios Mantos is joining me to talk about his book, The Social One, that is to come. We will talk about the song with reference to the manager, and we will talk about transfers, but we will start off with Liverpool 3, Bournemouth 1. I want the start, Stu, to be the start in the context of the start, to be something we come on to. So I'm just going to park that for a second. I want to start in terms of accentuating the positive of the game is that Liverpool create a lot of chances and create a lot of chances to create better chances against quite a good side. It's a sheer weight of attack and talent point. I think they can do better again with better decision making, but nonetheless, they really do create themselves a lot of opportunities.
They do. And I think, I don't think there's any surprises really. I think everyone going into the season was thinking, you know, we look great going forward. We've got a plethora of players there who are going to create chances, loads who are going to bag. But we've got a team setup which is prone to the occasional brain fart at the back. And I think, you know, that's what we saw in 95 minutes. That's exactly what we saw.
My concern on those though, what I was concerned about watching on Saturday, it was part of the start, but I think it's part of a wider thing, is the errors on halfway, more than the errors on the back. The errors when it's popped into not just midfield, but almost attacking midfield, you know, Jota and Salah and Diaz, when they're trying to link up little touches around the halfway line when we're trying to play out, and then we lose it, and everyone's going the other way. Do you know, like, I actually think Van Dijk plays really well over the course of the game, but that's what's concerning me, is that bit there, almost that strip, especially in that first 25 minutes.
Yeah, I noticed that in pre-season, particularly at the game against the German team at Preston's ground. I noticed that between the halfway line and their box, we are half loose with the ball. We're really, really loose with the ball, and we're not the team that we once were yet at regaining possession rapidly. And we are in danger of being, you know, carved wide open with one straight ball, often is the case, or a switch of play. So I think the fact that we see McAllister playing where he is doesn't help. I think, you know, once you get him into a more attacking position within that midfield, I think we're going to keep hold of the ball better. I think we're going to use it. I think we're going to recycle it better than what we're doing at the moment. But it all just feels a little bit all or nothing when it doesn't have to be in those moments. We can just work the move, work the opening.
Facts don't care about Stu's feelings, Josh. Because I share many of Stu's feelings, but it's worth pointing out that Bournemouth only have 3 relatively low-value chances after the goal until 70 minutes. Now, if you'd have said that to me coming out to the ground, I'd have called you a liar. Like, I've been checking stuff, as mad as it is. But that's the truth of it. And this is the oddness of this Liverpool side at the moment, that at times you look at highlights afterwards, you look at the stats stuff afterwards, and you're like, I'm sure it was worse than that.
Yeah.
And then the truth of it is that it isn't quite, but that's the tightrope it feels like they walk.
Yeah, it feels like it's indicative of the doubt that has crept back into us as a supporter base as well. And that is, you know, something that is evident in the team. You know, you've said we'll sort of talk about the starts later on, but it feels like there is a serious sort of level of doubt and almost, you know, easy discouragement within the team. And, you know, Klopp was talking about last week about Liverpool, you know, rushing to do things against Chelsea, and that rush was what was seeing Liverpool lose too much of the ball. He sort of scoffed at the percentage of possession that Liverpool had against Chelsea in his press conference before Bournemouth. It felt like they'd atoned for that sort of slightly in this Bournemouth game, and that I didn't feel like they were rushing at any point, but they were almost like just trying too much, like too many like tricky things to do. There's so many like little flicks and things that just didn't come off in this game. It was like there was times last season where they were going almost too much to prove they had a confidence. And I felt like that a couple of times against Bournemouth, particularly in that first half, where it was like they just tried to do like a little flick or a little something to get themselves out of danger that would get the crowd up. And instead they lost the ball. And instead it felt like Bournemouth, even if they didn't have a chance at the end of it, it was like you as a crowd go, oh God, not again. They're going to have another attack again. And it feels like every time Liverpool do that, every time Liverpool make a mistake, even if it's in, you know, Bournemouth's half in this game's case, it just feels like it's going to be like the end of the world, and like Bournemouth are going to get a great chance at the end of this. And as the stats prove, it's not true really, but I think it really is indicative of how much that sort of that doubt and maybe the sort of lack of, you know, trust almost has crept back in.
And that's come from the lack of control. I think that's where that's all born from, because you're right, when you look at it, the stats say that we aren't actually facing a lot of chances, but the point is that we feel like a chance could come at any time. We don't always feel like we are in control of the situation in the way that we should be, in the way that we have been at our best. And I think that's probably why it feels worse than it does, because I was like you, like I rewatched the game this morning, I was like, I swear the bad period lasted longer than that, and it didn't. And I swear Bournemouth were more threatening than that, and they weren't. But all of the things you said about what is wrong, I do think these are things that are actively, or at least I hope, are still actively being worked on. And that's kind of the point of the whole lopsided, attack-minded team in the first place. I think Klopp kind of looked, it's kind of circumstantial in as much as has been noted, all of our DMs are either injured or sold. So we're going to put all of the attacking lads in there. But also, when you are reconstructing a new midfield, it's going to take time. You've got to learn how to knit together properly. So you want to play at that speed. You want to do the flicks and tricks because you know that at your best, that's what you're going to be doing. But you're not there yet. And you're still trying to do it and it's not coming off. So by having so much attacking talent, you've saying you've got a lot of guys who can produce a moment of magic, and we might just have to shoot our way out of a few games while we're getting used to it. And I mean, that's exactly what happened. Luis Diaz produced a moment of magic. The game changed. Bournemouth decided to give us a little bit more time and space, and we were able to build into our play.
Do you think that Bournemouth decided to give us a bit more time and space, or do you think that they tired? Because I think this is a fine detail, and to talk about the start before talking about the refereeing, move on to that, Mo. I think there's a bit of a problem, which is that obviously the opposition are at their freshest for the first however many minutes of a game. What with them not having done any running before that point? This isn't rocket science. No one here is saying that I'm a sports scientist. But they are at their freshest when they have done less work. Mm-hmm. And then what happens is they go through that period of time in the first 20, 30 minutes. And I thought that Bournemouth looked, I thought they looked knackered from about 30, 35. Yeah. I thought they looked shot. And they only really regain the legs on about 85. But the point about that, though, is that this is where I'm like, so Liverpool, why don't we just not do anything daft? Or if Jurgen Klopp was sitting here, would he say, well, the thing is that we're stretching them by virtue of the fact that we're taking risks and we're making them spring that bit more? At which point I'm like, Jurgen, shut up.
I mean, that's the theory. And you can understand why he would say that. But no, I'm like you. And I've got bad news for you, Josh. Clearly, the lads aren't watching the team talk, because you and I said exactly this. Like, I literally rewatched the clip that you put up on the Instagram. Go and watch it now, of what I said about how Bournemouth will come out of the traps and have lots of intensity. Mm. And they'll wait and see if Liverpool give them a stupid mistake. Well, guess what? That's exactly what happened.
It's this vicious circle for me, Stu, in that, you know, Villa will watch the video of that and go, I tell you what, you could get something out of this from Liverpool early on. And also, you can look at what happened with them last season and go, you can get something out of this. And then you've just got to stand strong somehow towards the end of the match. And Villa nearly manage it, although in the end, we even arguably deserve to win that one against Villa at the back end of last season, because Villa also themselves wilt over time. They wilt. But I'd rather team to Wilton and haven't scored, if you see what I mean. Can you wilt when it's still at zero, please? Because it'd help.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to get used to it to an extent, because I think Liverpool have evolved into a team that pretty much never seems to start quickly in games now. The manager's very, very determined for the team to be a team that develops control over the game, takes the sting out of the game early on, and almost, you know, suffocates the opposition as the game wears on. And I think opposition teams know it. You only have to look at what the manager was saying about the possession last week, not rushing things. And I think the team was going in to games with the instruction of calm it down, don't rush, keep the ball, work your openings. And I think that's all fine, but I think that there's a strong argument to be saying, do you know what, the first 10 minutes of games, though, you should be fighting fire with fire. You should be making sure that there's a very, very fair message to the opposition of you are getting nothing here. We're going to be first to every ball. We weren't first to every ball. We're not generally in that first 10 minutes of a game. We're going to be first to every ball. You're not getting anything out of us. And I think there's a lot of truth in what you've said about the opposition tiring through the games, but I don't think that those two things actually are mutually exclusive.
I think both
are true. We should be starting with greater fire in games, and then once that fight is won in the first 10 minutes and nothing stupid has happened, then we exert that control.
Yeah. This is just
on that, Neil, you only have to see as well how Bournemouth started the game. Bournemouth allowed our two centre halves to have the ball, but everyone else, there was a full court press. There was five of their players who were pressing when we had the ball on the edge of our own box, or our keeper had it. Every other player apart from in our half, apart from our centre halves, but particularly where they were killing the space, they were putting three men onto our two, onto where they knew Trent would be trying to pick the ball up in his new six position when we've got the ball, and onto McAllister. They were laying traps for what came off as their first goal.
And that's what I was about to say was, and that gives them, Stuart, gives them further encouragement. The disallowed goal gives them encouragement for the goal. And this is what concerns me about us, is that this is the cycle that I feel as though we're just a teeny little bit locked in, especially at home, and especially weirdly against sides that you maybe say are somewhere between the 8th and 15th best teams in the division. It feels as though we are dangling a carrot. And I can see the argument to dangle the carrot. I just think that when you lose seven consecutive carrots, you maybe rethink the carrot plan.
Yeah, we're just a bit loose with that. I think there's got to be a difference between if the manager is saying, if they're under instruction to, you know, to stay calm, to build the play, to not rush into, that doesn't mean switch off. That doesn't mean be overconfident or too relaxed. And I think there is an element of being too relaxed. I think there'll be those who say that the Trent potentially is too relaxed in those situations. However, I've got a slightly different view on that. I think when you look at how he was robbed of possession, he has not played most of his career in this position. He is now receiving the ball facing the centre backs. You need an experienced six there who's worked his way through his professional career in that position. He's on the half turn. He's got, or certainly got, an open stance, ready to play on the turn. Trent's square. Trent is caught square. He's not on his toes, which you've got to be. I mean, that's what we've just been talking about in that first 10 minutes of games. Everyone's got to be on the toes, and he's not. And he is a little bit loose there. But his body shape is wrong. And they're ready for it.
Yeah.
They're ready for it. And then, you know, it's a slightly heavy touch and they've absolutely swamped him. So I think there is an argument to say that individuals could be a little bit sharper. But I also think there's a development point there as well, potentially for Trent, who I think could be exceptional in that position. But I think his body shape,
I think he improves through the game. Yeah, I think he improves through every game he plays.
But that's a story of Liverpool.
Yeah, but I think part of that is it's all a teaching, and not just for him, but for Jürgen as well. Because one thing you did see after the goal is that it wasn't him splitting the centre-backs, taking the ball from Alisson, that was McAllister. And I think when you are playing that hybrid role, there is a big difference between a right-back who comes a little bit infield to give the keeper an option alongside the DM and being the guy who's splitting the centre-backs. Because when you're the guy splitting the centre-backs, everyone spreads out in front of you. And what Bournemouth were doing, you were right, they were laying the trap. They had three guys in and around the D at all points, blocking passing lanes, but also ready to pounce. And that's exactly what happened. And the idea of having Trent as a midfielder, I think, it's still a good one. But the idea of having Trent as the DM, the six, the almost the sole guy doing all of that, I think is still a flawed one for that, because there's so much still to learn and so much of it is nuance. So much of it is just legs in that position. And if you're going to be doing it at this point, then you're going to have people swarming all over him. You're going to have teams game planning for it. I mean, you saw the game plan straight away. The thing that I keep seeing in Liverpool's mistakes, defensive mistakes, is we're always running after players who are already behind us on the way to goal. And defending is a lot easier when they're coming towards you than when you're chasing after them. And you saw that with the first goal. Robertson gets back. He makes the tackle, but because he's chasing back, the tackle goes to the guy behind him who just comes in and slams it. Mm. And it's just so much harder to get control of the situation, get control of your body when you're chasing after than when you've got it in front of you to play out in front. And Bournemouth were really good at working out how to get us chasing back. They had us chasing back to our own goal inside the first minute. Inside the first minute. And we were talking before about intent and about the difference between playing calm and growing into the game and fighting fire with fire. And even talking about the teams in the middle ranks who maybe you don't necessarily think are as much of a threat or you believe you should beat. That's the difference. That's where you have to be able to say, okay, we're going to be calm and controlled, but we're not going to give any gaps away. Man City aren't chasing back to their own goal inside the first minute.
What's odd about this, though, Josh, is that the sending off, we'll come on to it in a second, in terms of the referee's decision, but it changes things massively. And I was worried that that allows a reset for Bournemouth and they start doing the things that Mo suggests. And they're nowhere near us. They're nowhere near being able to do that. So that's the odd thing about this team, in that it's that because the vulnerabilities come early and often, it does feel like they feel so prominent. And then at exact a moment where I thought, oh God, we may end up chasing our own tails here and falling backwards, we actually go up the other end and completely control the game, dominate possession, dominate territory and score a goal. And I'm like, lads, this something just doesn't quite stack up even here in amongst all of this. And that's still the oddness of this side. I mean, they show so much sense and character for the 10 minutes after sending off.
Yeah, it is really strange. Like, I remember saying so many times last season that this Liverpool side, and I felt it, you know, this season, in the Chelsea game in particular, it was so prevalent that this Liverpool side are just too easily discouraged. But the sort of flip side of that is, at Anfield in particular, they're so easily encouraged as well. And we as a crowd are like, you know, no one in the ground on Saturday really, maybe a couple of debates on the cop and things like that, but no one truly thought that was a red card. Everyone was a bit like, that's not it. And then when everyone's, you know, looking at the videos on the phone, you can quite clearly see it's not a red card. And suddenly we've all got our backs up then, because we're like, well, no, this is now an injustice. Like, if we go on to lose this game, we're not having this. And the players sort of give you that vibe as well. I saw Szoboszlai's interview after the game where he was saying, you know, when a teammate gets sent off, you almost put your arms around each other as a team and say, we're gonna do this, you know, almost for the player that's been sent off now, which I really sort of like that sentiment, because it is the idea of, you know, we're not just gonna take this lying down. And if the decision is as bad as that one is, I think that even increases further that sort of feeling of injustice. And I really felt that in the ground. I felt like Liverpool's best spell of the game was with 10 men after the sending off, which is mad really, because as I say, this is a Liverpool side that's sort of too easily discouraged in moments, that's lacking so much control. But then they're giving themselves, they almost give themselves these reset points of like, no, now is when we really ramp our mentality up.
The referee and Stu, there's a big push for more respect this season. It was part of the whole FA's thing over the course of the summer. I genuinely don't think we're refereed in good faith at Anfield. I said it last season, I was hoping there might have been some degree of a reset. Now, I want to be really clear about this. He gives us a penalty that's innocuous. He could easily not give it, and I've seen us not get that on a regular basis, especially where Salah's concerned. I can argue he could send Alisson in the early part there. I think Konate's clever as he's running back, but I would always point out that the thing that's always forgotten when a keeper comes out is there isn't another keeper after that point. So I want to be clear about this. This isn't me saying, oh, the referees, they all hate us, etc., etc. But I think there's a thing where certain things are viewed at Anfield in a different light. I think I'm very rarely vexed about the refereeing away from home. I was one of the people who actually thought that Taylor had a good game last weekend at Chelsea. I understand why other people didn't, and it felt hard lines with the penalty. But I just don't feel as though it's good. As I said, I just keep saying the same thing. I just don't think we're refereed in good faith at Anfield. I think there's always a referee who's about to show that he's prepared to stick it to Anfield. And maybe I'm just completely wrong, but that's what it looks like.
No, it's really difficult to make a case against you, really. But if I'm trying to be objective and almost remove Liverpool and Anfield, if you like, from the equation, which is really hard to do when Paul Tierney, who was on VAR, is absolutely anywhere near our ground or any game that we're playing in. But if I try and take us out of the equation, I was having a bit of a think about this over the weekend with the respect call. And I saw, when I got home, someone sent to me, what's this fellow who's now, the ex-referee who's now on Sky?
Dean.
Dean, yeah. I saw a clip of him justifying the decision. you know, he's got it in slow motion there, and he's saying, oh, yeah, no, I can see why he's done it. Yeah, fair decision. It's a red card. And he's the only man on the planet, by the way, who I've heard say that it is a red card. And I think it's really, really hard for, you know, cries of greater respect to be taken seriously when referees are so unaccountable, so aloof. They come across so aloof, and then they just back the mates no matter what. That's what it comes across like. You know, even within VAR, we saw within the first years of that how reluctant VAR were, and still are, as we saw on Saturday, to make the referee go and have another look at things, to challenge the referee on the on-field referee's decision. I think the only way the greater respect is going to come for referees is when the time comes, if it ever does come, that they are able to be interviewed after games and take a human approach and say, I got that one wrong. I'm human, you know. And I think people will accept that. I do think people will accept that. You know, personally, if a referee makes a mistake, we're all human. And even VAR, until it becomes run by AI, which I'm more and more getting on board with, to be quite honest with. But until VAR is taken out of human hands, again, there's still going to be a level of subjectivity and mistakes. I would be able to get my head around it a lot more if they weren't so removed, aloof, and not accountable to the supporters.
It's the likely suspension that kills me on this one, yeah. Mo, because I feel it is a massive climb down if they don't do the suspension at this point. And first and foremost, I just really want to watch the footballer. In a really basic way, I really want to watch the footballer. We're unlikely to be able to now in the league for 3 games, 1 game, we'll find out. I really want them to be able to say, you know what, it's not violent conduct, it's not a red card. You were punished during the game. Mm. If you want to say it's an orange, you copped for it and you managed to win the game. We all move on. As Stu says, though, I just don't feel as though anyone can find that backtrack.
No, because the other thing that we have to factor in is not just the Anfield factor, it's the fact of where we are in the season, i.e. at the beginning of it. And we've seen it, we've all seen it year in, year out, where there's a new directive and it's enforced very strictly early on to try and send a message, and then they kind of walk it back. So there's going to be opportunities. There's going to be games next weekend, the weekend after, the weekend after, where there's a tackle exactly the same as that, that isn't even given a yellow card. And people are going to be like, why was that one and why was that one? Because they're trying to set the standard now. And that's how it moves forward. That's when you look back at Premier League games from 10 years ago and you see decisions that aren't given and you know that they'd be given now, there isn't one massive sea change. It's just little incremental bits where it moves and it moves and it moves. And these are the kind of things where it moves along. We are on the short end of the stick on this regard. So we're going to have to cop for it. I unfortunately think that they aren't going to change it because they're looking at it from a scientific point of view. So they're almost saying, okay, foot makes contact with leg at this juncture. That is reckless, when the reality is it's not. It's the difference between doing that and doing that. And that's why it's a scientific and not a football decision, if you want to call it that. And because that's where the subjective element comes in, I don't think we're ever fully going to square that circle.
The other part of it that drove me mad is part of the reason why he's a teeny bit late is he has to run around the referee. which is part of the reason why he's a teeny bit late. Okay. Great stuff so far from Josh, Mo and Stu. Coming up in a second, we're going to be chatting away about individual performances and asking whether or not you'd have the awkward conversation with Mo Salah on the penalties.
Life is a highway,
and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Wearing a Men's Warehouse outfit makes you confident, like you could do anything, so you dance like no one is watching, even though everyone is watching. Because of the Men's Warehouse outfit, you interview like the job is already yours because it is. Because of the Men's Warehouse outfit, you golf as if the rules don't apply to you because you're too well-dressed for rules. Because of the Men's Warehouse outfit. At Men's Warehouse, get measured, get fitted, get hot, get confident in everything from tailored suits to underwear and all the stuff in between. Love the way you look at Men's Warehouse.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at ikea-usa.com today.
Individual performances, worked through a couple of them, Josh. Dominic Szoboszlai was just the absolute business. It was such a way to announce yourself to an Anfield crowd. I thought he looked great at Stamford Bridge, but it is always a little bit different seeing a player in person, and I think he is the sort of footballer that will come on in person. I think he's also the sort of footballer that will come on for playing for Liverpool Football Club.
Yeah, I have to admit, I was already wrong about Dominic Szoboszlai, and not in a way that I thought he was going to be crap for Liverpool. I basically thought he was going to be have sort of a similar first season to Darwin Núñez, and in that they come with that same sort of explosiveness, don't they? He's you know, Dominic Szoboszlai, all the highlights you see is, you know, sprints away from people, running into a press, it's free kicks and long shots and all these kinds of things. And I think sometimes those explosive players, they're the ones who do your head in the most. And actually what I've seen from him in the first two games of the season in particular, not so much in pre-season. Pre-season probably gave me evidence that thought, oh yeah, he's going to be really hit and miss, this lad. Actually, he just looks like he's got so much purpose, so much solidity to his game. And I think you see that at the weekend, and all the sort of stats kicking around about his progressive carries. He was talking, I'll keep referencing this interview after the game because I loved it, to be honest. He was talking about when he had to get withdrawn to the six and the manager's shouting at him because he sort of forgets he can't go forward as much at times. He feels like he's got so much sort of sense and intelligence to his game. And I really do think you see that at the weekend. He makes everything good happen in a Liverpool sense. And that's what I thought McAllister would be in it. And to a degree, it is what McAllister's been so far as well. So you know, the both of them are such exciting signings. And I'm so happy to have been wrong, because I think, you know, I expect him to sort of introduce himself to this season with a moment. And I remember saying to you, oh, it'll be about March. He'll score a goal against someone at home that'll keep us in the title race. I had this big idea in my head. He's already given us that game in that moment, and it's the second game of the season at Anfield. He's already sort of had his coming out party now, and I'm so excited to see where he can take it for the rest of the season.
I think there's something about him, because I remember watching him at Leipzig, and I, like you, Josh, there were times when it wouldn't come off for him, and he's kind of like in and out, but when he was good, he was so good. He just reminds me a little bit of Sadio, in terms of when he just came to the crest of the wave. And when we first got Sadio, all the Southampton fans were saying, yeah, he's good when he's good, but he's not always good. And then Sadio was like, nah, I hear what you're saying. I'm ready to move on now. And that purpose you mentioned, that's like, no, this is what Dominic Szoboszlai is going to represent from here on in. And I feel like he's attacked his Liverpool career like that. And I'm here for it.
Isn't it great when you sign a player and you get to see him play and you're just like, oh, we've got one here. We've got one here. He is brilliant. He's absolutely mustard. I mean, it's a short sample size so far, but Christ, he is brilliant. Absolutely.
Do you think part of what helps him is, you know, this idea of, because I think that we're about 3 weeks away from sides needing a Szoboszlai plan. And the point about that at the minute is that teams have got a Trent plan, and they want to have a Salah plan, and they quite like to have a Jota plan, like a Diaz plan. And I think part of what happens there on Saturday is that Bournemouth just haven't got enough plans, or you can't have plans for everyone. And suddenly, here he is. And I just think that helps him massively, Stu, because I think he's going to make teams go, we need to sort him out, at which point then there's more space for others.
No, I hear what you're saying, but some players come along and they've got everything in terms of physically as well. I mean, he's an absolute unit. He's so powerful, and you could have 50 plans against Steven Gerrard and he was breaking through, he was smashing through every single one of them. And when you look at this lad, you think he could do the same. He's so powerful, and his pace and acceleration is it's so surprising for a lad that size, and, you know, carrying that much bulk, that much strength. The one where he leaves the two Bournemouth players for dead on the touchline is just a thing of beauty.
Is that the one where he just ran into Diaz? Diaz like, lad.
Honestly, I think he's my new favourite player. I want to give him one of those Chelsea 10-year contracts already. I'm so excited to see where he's gone. But he's 22.
Yeah.
Oh, dear Lord. We're going to have fun with him. Brilliant.
Different, Diogo Jota, Mo. He grew into the game, and then he became its defining force. And if you'd have said to me after 30 minutes, Diogo Jota is going to become this game's defining force, I'd have said, are you absolutely kidding me? It wasn't even just a grew into, and I don't think it's as simple as, oh, when he gets his goal and he goes up a level, because he's up a level before he scores the goal. He's beginning to be absolutely everywhere. He actually does brilliantly. We obviously love the Diaz finish, but Jota does brilliantly in that little period, and it felt to me like that kicked him on.
Yeah.
And I thought he was excellent second half, genuinely excellent.
Yeah, it's funny, because you'd have said, are you kidding me? And I'd have said, well, no, this is Jota. This is what he does. This we see this do so many times where you think, oh, Joss is having a bit of a funny one here. And then all of a sudden, oh, no, he's not. He's all over the place. And there was one chance in the first half where Trent pings it across and he tries to take a touch when on fire Jota is hitting that first time into the bottom corner. And I think he kind of admonished himself in his head. And that kind of like went, no, we need to play better. And he did start to pick it up a bit. He is still hit and miss in terms of doing the link play bits, but he is now, his energy is a real force, and he's able to, now he's got someone like Szoboszlai alongside him, they can kind of really press as a pack, and that really works for him. But he was the leader, I think, in the second half, because even before the goal and the sending off, I feel like we came out of that second half smelling blood. Bournemouth, like you said, their legs are gone by then. They were looking ragged. And it was that point where you feel like, okay, we need to get the goal that kills this game now. And there was a real urgency. And Jota kind of epitomised that more than anyone. He was the one arriving. He was the one gambling on any time that there was a ball over. He was going to the back post, see if it was there. And as we saw with the shot from Szoboszlai. And I remember saying before came along that the thing about him being a goal threat from outside the box isn't just about the goals he scores. It's about the chaos he creates, the space he creates. And sometimes if a keeper makes a poor mistake, there are balls in the 6-yard box to tap in for someone like Jota.
Diaz was everything you want. I think he actually tires a little bit second half, Diaz. I think he could go a little bit earlier, but I think trying to do the subs in bulk is still a challenge for all managers trying to make that work. But I thought he was everything that you wanted, especially for the first hour or so. Really, really dangerous, and I'm just loving him getting between the posts.
Definitely is. I think there's been a clear sort of directive for him to be more direct from the coaching staff. It really does feel that way. And like, I always understood the ways in which you'd get frustrated with him, because there'd often be times where it felt like he had like yards and yards to run into, and he'd come inside so early. And you almost show yourself then, because you allow the defence to shift across that extra bit. If the pass is there to Salah out on the right-hand side, that defence can shift across a bit and sort of, you know, go back to their Mo Salah plan of making sure he's denied the ball. And that was frustrating at times. I don't think you've really seen any of that from Diaz so far this season. He is playing so direct, and it was a thing that really you could see that was so obvious in pre-season, as well as the angle in which he's running at defenders now. He's going to cause so many more problems for defenders this season. He's going to score so many more goals this season, and I'm pleased with the way that he takes that goal at the weekend, because I think that's exactly what Diaz can be, in that I think he's got all the sort of explosiveness in the world, but he's really, really intelligent football as well, and that's a really intelligent finish, because the deflection comes, he has to adjust his body to where he's receiving the ball, and then he almost has to adjust it again in midair, because he's like, oh, this ball's come up in a really weird way here. I'm going to have to kick it a bit quicker, basically, and you sort of see that he's almost like leaning back, and then he just swipes his foot through the ball, and the keeper's got absolutely no chance. None of the defenders got absolutely no chance. And I always think back to the Gerrard thing of, I think it was about Suarez and Sturridge, wasn't it? Maybe even Stern, 13-14 season, like all the best dealing with them. Like, if you honestly, if you're making Mo Salah plans, if you're making Diogo Jota plans, all the best with your Luis Diaz plan as well.
There's on the intelligence point, Stu, I actually thought it's amongst the best games I've seen him and Roberts have together. I thought Robertson was really good. I think for the second consecutive game, other people don't. But I thought Robertson was really good, picked his moments well. And then when he's there and around the penalty area, he's just lovely to link up with. And I thought that Diaz and Robertson got the best out of each other over the course of that game. Both were unfortunate not to end up with an assist.
As Josh said then, he's so intelligent, the way he uses the ball, and he's patient with it. It might not seem like it, because everything happens so quick, but you can see his brain is constantly ticking over at lightning speed, looking at weighing up all the options, all the possibilities. If he moves this way, if he feigns that way, who can move into the space, who can he play off, or should he just beat the man, you know? And I love it when he beats a man. You know, I think I'm a big fan and big advocate of players beating men, because I'm old school in terms of, I always think that opens up space for others as soon as you take a man out the game. But I do want more. I want more defensively from him. And this is not to say that he doesn't work hard. I think he works extremely hard. But it's that combination that you just referenced then, actually, between Robertson and Diaz when off the ball. I think that the partnership and the knowledge of each other's movements and positional play isn't quite there yet in the same way that we were spoilt with Mane and Robertson. But I want to throw another name into the mix as well. We were spoilt with a triangle of Mane, Wijnaldum and Robertson down that side, both on the ball and off the ball. They were tremendous. And I think it hasn't been helped by the fact that we're playing Gakpo in that role in midfield at the moment instead of McAllister in that left-sided centre midfield position. I would like to think that once that's locked down with the preferred three, which is very frustrating for the reason you said before about the potential suspension, but once that's locked down, I really would like to see us having a much greater sense of control when we are defending down that side. I was like you last week in terms of I thought Robertson got a lot of stick, and much of it was unfair, I felt, because he was basically facing a two or three on one situation relentlessly.
With James and Sterling, they were both good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sterling just absolutely murdered West Ham for the first half yesterday.
Our issues with Robertson have been more around the change of system and making the right decisions positionally when we're on and off the ball, but not about his one-on-one play. His one-on-one play is still good, and he's still got the legs to be able to keep up with the best of them. But when he's outnumbered, and he's used to a very tight system at Liverpool over the years, where he's been protected, as we have been on the other side. Once that's removed, then I think it's very difficult. And I think that's just a position on the pitch and area on the field that I would like to see us grow and develop as the games went on.
I feel really sorry for him, you know. Because essentially this whole change of system was foisted upon him. He didn't have a say in the matter. And the point of it is that when he's at his best, when he's a third centre-back, part of the defensive line, he's not able to do the Robbo things that he does so well. But he's like, look, guys, I can do these things really well. Can't you see? These things that were such a big part of all of our success not long ago. Because obviously we talk about the influence of Trent, but Robbo's influence in terms of attacking is kind of underrated still, I think.
Yeah.
And so we're all talking about the fact, oh, well, it's a problem now. And that's the problem for Robbo is that him underlapping Diaz into the six-yard box is great. But because of the way we've got this system, it's also a problem because it's the kind of thing that other teams are trying to game plan for. So when he's there, we need you to do this and go. And that's why you get overloads. So I think the problem isn't really with what he's doing. I think it's with how we square what everyone else is doing. And I think Stu's right in terms of having Mac alongside him in there. I think it's probably going to help fortifying that. I do think he's doing a better job of learning when to go and when to stay. I think that's something that will build as well. But yeah, I feel sorry for him because like he's still a great attacking force. And I don't think that he should be forced to give that up just because of what the system we're playing decrees.
I think we're going to spend the season saying, I'll tell you what, Stu, Van Dijk's playing well. Without anyone ever sort of, I thought he was excellent. I think it's his second consecutive game of being excellent. I thought he defended the halfway line really, really well. I thought Van Dijk was really good.
I do as well. I think he looks far more like his old self. I think he's making better decisions. I think when he's looking after his own game in particular, I think he looks really, really strong. I think part of the issue that we were just discussing about Robertson, I actually felt last week part of the issue though was our defensive line was so deep. When we were away from home, when we're up against it, I think there has become a greater tendency for us to drop, and you can see the manager last year was going bananas about it. And all it's doing is opening the space between the midfield, those half spaces which Reece James and Sterling were able to take advantage of. Those spaces wouldn't be there if we were braver and we pushed out. And that's his job. He's the captain of the team. He's certainly the leader of that line. And I'd like to see us, when we're away from home and when we are in those moments up against it, I'd like to see him get us out more and have that little bit of confidence, that bit of belief that we're going to squeeze that space, give them nothing, and back ourselves on the turn if anything gets put in behind. And once that happens, I will be absolutely rock solid in my head that Van Dijk is back.
Does he have the confidence yet?
That's what I'm a little bit. But I think to help them, it's his responsibility to shut down that space. I think when he's nervous about those in front of him and makes that decision or is just erring on that side of caution, I think it's accentuating the problem. And I think that's part of the issue that Robertson was so exposed last week. Doesn't happen if we kill that space. So let's back ourselves and let's get 5 to 10 yards further up the pitch.
Endo makes me laugh. Made me laugh massively. He won a tackle and bombed on. I was like, lad, we're all right for that. You just sit in. Don't get carried away with being at Anfield. Sheffield seems sound enough given everything. We'll talk about recruitment in a minute or two. I've got a mild worry that he can't necessarily turn round. But then I'm worried about that with most footballers. Josh, you're going to have the awkward conversation with Salah if you're Jurgen Klopp this week. If I'm Mo, I'll do the stats. If I'm Mo, I'm going on LFC history and I'm printing off the page that I sent to all of you and showing the manager that his conversion rate is 81%, which is better than XG on a penalty is 78. He's better than Phil Neal, who's took more penalties for Liverpool than anyone apart from Steven Gerrard, 74.5. Steven Gerrard is 82%. Barnes was 66%. Michael Owen was worse than me, and I never even played for the club. there's other footballers in there as well. Rushy, 50%. Rushy took six, scored three, missed three. Hey, Rushy, good to see you. There was a way he couldn't score a goal because he knew all the other ways he was bossed them. I think there's a weird thing with the Josh where he's never entirely convinced. So the stats suggest he is, you know, he scores four and five of them. And as I say, that is better than the suspected average, but he's never entirely convinced. But I do sort of wonder, to be fair to him, whether or not this keeper's in his head a bit.
Yeah, I think there was a period where he did convince, but funnily enough, it was the period where James Milner was playing so much that James Milner was like, you know, the bona fide first option penalty taker. I remember there being, it was Huddersfield at Anfield, Mo scores a penalty, maybe Huddersfield away actually. And around that time, I remember thinking, Salah doesn't miss penalties. Like we've got two lads there who just don't miss penalties. And I think around that time, that was probably the period where he did convince and his penalties were really good. And almost the more he's taken them, I wonder whether he's getting in his own head a little bit. I mean, we constantly wonder that with Salah, don't we? And I wonder whether, actually for me, it's not the awkward conversation. It's the manager just needs to light a bit of a fire under him. And I almost don't know how you do that with Salah, because there feels like there's about a million things where we go, this will light a fire under Salah, this will do this. And it's quite strange, really, sometimes the things that light a fire under him and sometimes the things that don't. Sometimes things he just lets happen and lets go. I hope he doesn't let these kind of conversations go. I really want Mo to sort of, you know, have a big think about the way he approaches penalties, really approach him with that sort of, you know, I mentioned before about trying not to show you're too confident on the ball. I want Mo to start just absolutely bladdering. And I know he does try and bladder this one. Andy was saying to me in the ground, it was almost like the one he takes in the European Cup final, that it's close to the keeper, it's low, it's hard. I want to see him start smashing some into the stanchions. And listen, there'll be a couple that go wrong in doing that. But I want to see some of them just properly nestle in the top corner. I can go, that's the confidence.
See, I mean, if you want to light a fire on him, just remind him that missing a penalty loses him FPL points, because he's really important in there to him, clearly. But I was going to say I have a theory on this, but the truth is my dad has a theory on this, because we got into it about penalties, about Salah and penalties after the Bournemouth game last season where he missed. My dad's theory is that it's about control. Lots of things are always about control. If you look at all the great penalty takers down history, Beppe Signore, Matt Letizia, all those kind of guys, they all had a calm, measured approach to the ball. They all looked like they were in control of the situation. They could change last minute. Salah's approach is quick. He does that thing where he does that circular run and he comes and he's trying to build up momentum for the shot. And you can see why he's doing it, because he's normally trying to hit the ball hard. But it loses that kind of control. So the goalkeeper doesn't have that feeling of like, oh, I know exactly. He knows exactly what he's doing. There's that bit of trepidation. And that's probably why to us it looks like he's not quite as good at it. Now, I think that I've got a theory on how to get him better as well. Because you're right. The things that light a fire under him is the threat of losing it. And we do have lots of other players in this team who can take penalties. McAllister, Szoboszlai. There are a few others who think that they could do it. So if I'm Klopp, I'm going to him, all right, Friday after training, every week, penalty competition. If you win, you're taking penalties on Saturday. If you don't, someone else is. That will keep him going, because then he'll be practicing. He'll be thinking about it. He'll be like, no. Because the other thing we have to factor in as well is that we've talked a lot about Mo being more of a creator this season and how he's kind of thriving and flourishing that. That's because he's still on penalties. Like, he knows he's still going to get goals because he's on penalties. He does not want to be taken off penalties. So you've got to make it. So if you keep on there, you have to make that standard.
Quick, are you going to have the conversation with him or not?
That's the conversation I'm having with, can you just hit the corners, please? Just hit the corners. Just stop absolutely smashing it within, you know, a foot of the goalkeeper either side, and we won't be having this conversation at all again. Just hit the corners. You know what he needs to do? Remember, like, the old tour at Liverpool, and there was a little game for the kids where you could go and take a penalty, and you had to get it in the circles that were in the corners?
Yeah.
Just get him a few hours a day on that.
A few hours a day.
All right, Mo. He'll soon sit. He'll soon at the corners. Be sitting
yeah,
at.
Yeah.
Tuesdays, Mo, 12 till 5. The Stu Wright was on a podcast. You might have excellent stuff. Marios Mantos came in to talk to me about his book, The Social One. This is me talking to him, and then after that, we're going to talk about the manager and the song, and then we're going to have a chat about transfers.
This episode is brought to you by Bye. It's Wonderwater. What makes Bai so great? It's simple. From raspberry lemon lime by Sydney Sweeney to Zambia Bing cherry and Palavo pineapple mango, Bai has antioxidants, electrolytes, and no artificial sweeteners. So for flavorful hydration, choose Bai. It's Wonderwater. Learn more about Bai and discover all of the exotic, bold flavors at drinkbai.com.
Joined by Marios Mantos, who's written a book called The Social One, which is about how Jurgen Klopp was a perfect fit for Liverpool. And Marios, one of the things that struck me reading the book was, and you frame it quite nicely, that Jurgen, he is a perfect fit for Liverpool, has been a perfect fit, but if he'd have known he was this perfect a fit, or what the role was, the way in which what manager being manager of Liverpool can be like, he might have actually been a bit reluctant to take on the mantle of such pressure, mightn't he?
Yeah, yeah. Because we were talking about this off record, that he's a man that he's himself. He is himself. He's what you see on and off the camera. You know it better than me. And yes, he came here to manage a football team. He didn't came here to manage the people of the city. But that's what the outcome was.
Well, it's funny that is the outcome, because for me, being Liverpool manager has always felt, growing up, like it's such an enormous role. You end up with pressure from all over the place. And I feel like the best Liverpool managers, you mentioned, for instance, Rafa Benitez in the book as well, the best Liverpool managers find the way to make it their own. And that's what I think is most impressive about Jurgen. It's not just obviously being successful on the pitch massively helps with that, but the best Liverpool managers find the way to be themselves whilst almost changing the role, making it fit them like a glove, and that's what he's done so well.
Yeah, thank you so much for your kind words. The manager of Liverpool Football Club is a special person. It's a figure that the people of the city are looking to his eyes and waiting to see the same. There's themselves. They want the manager of the football club to be the mirror of themselves. And you know, Jurgen was growing up as a football fan first and foremost. He was a passionate fan of Stuttgart.
Yep.
So he knows very well how it is to be a fan and what the fan wants. Passion, true love for football, true love for the club. So,
but also, as you put in the book, also honesty. Like that feels like an important thing to Liverpool. You make that argument within the book that, you know, using the words of other people who've spoken about it as well, that they say that honesty becomes, you know, one of the most important things for people in Liverpool. They want someone who will be themselves, tell it like it is, doesn't sugar anything, just is very direct. And Jurgen's honesty, I think, shines through in everything that he does.
Yeah, of course. An example I remember from the book about honesty is the Adam Lallana example, when he was informed by Jurgen that next season he would not have the role that he used to have. So he talked to Adam and said to him, if you want to go, you can go. And right after that chat, Adam Lallana equalised against Manchester United at Old Trafford. So that was the psychology part of the thing. It was a sad part for Adam, but he was really happy for and really blessed for the honesty of Jurgen. And that was what he gave him the psychology to lift up.
When you're writing the book, what strikes me as interesting is you're obviously using a lot of political language. And Jurgen himself doesn't use political language, but he does make political actions. And that to me is, it's an interesting dichotomy in a way. He is someone whose motivations for actions come from this place. But then in that way, you know, without sort of weighing it down with political significance, he the way in which he conducts himself and what the way in which he acts and what he wants and the way in which he views a football team, it does have a political element to it.
Yeah, of course. And I call him a socialist, but he never calls himself a socialist.
He does say he's left of centre, but he has said that.
So, yes. There's a kind of socio-political analysis in the book about Jürgen, and that's the comparison with Bill Shankly. He lives and works with the principles of teamwork, fellow love.
But also communitarianism. Yeah, togetherness and communitarianism is one that you mentioned in the book, and I think it's a really powerful part that he genuinely doesn't believe that things can be achieved without that communitarianism, both in terms of 11 players, but also in terms of thousands, millions of Liverpool supporters around the world. That's what matters to him.
Yeah, and that is what football is about. Football is a team sport, a sport that with different players of different level of quality combine the attributes and work for the same goal. If there is a sport that can summarize the socialism part is football. So, yeah.
Did you enjoy writing the book?
Yeah, I learned a lot more writing the book about what I knew before. I knew less before, and it was a quite exceptional and interesting process of writing the book. So yes, I wrote it to Greek, and it was published in Greek in 2020. So. From 2023 is in English.
But you've added some stuff in English since the 2020 version. You've updated a little bit.
A little bit. So just things that, Sadio Mane have left, Gini Wijnaldum have left. Here comes COVID. Darwin Nunez and COVID, of course, and some things that Jürgen have said, but not a lot. Because that's the power of this book is that it's, not for now, it's forever.
Yep.
Because the things that I wrote here are not affected by the how the team is going.
Yep. Okay, it is excellent. It's called The Social One. It is now in English, and it is worth reading. You get it from all the places you get books from. It is published by Pitch Publishing, so you could go direct to them. There are many other different places to buy books, but thank you very much indeed.
The English in Shy is much better than mine.
Yours is fine. Get off your own back. It is The Social One. It's a pleasure to speak to Marius. He's having a lovely weekend in Liverpool, by the way. Gets to do a book signing, wanders around the place, has a great time on the tour. What a week he's having. What a week we all are. The Social One, check it out. Thank you very much to Marius for coming in. Let's move forward. If you want to download anything from the Anfield app, you can use the app. We're now also on Patreon. That exists as well. There is no difference between what's on Patreon and what's on the app. I feel as though we'll have to say this 100 times, but it is, I promise you, true. There is no difference between what's on Patreon and what's on the app. So if you've got the app and you've downloaded and you're into everything, brilliant, thank you. The Patreon thing's just for people who prefer to use Patreon. And you can also subscribe through the website.
The same with YouTube, by the way, because I get asked that question a lot. YouTube and the video offering exactly the same.
Yeah, you get all the videos on YouTube. That's it. If you want to use YouTube for your videos, it's there, it's available, but you don't get any of the audio stuff. That's the way in which it works on that one. There's Patreon, there is the app, there is the YouTube, there is also a free trial for a week on Patreon. That's the one thing that is different. If you do sign up through Patreon, you can have a free trial for a week. But apart from that, it is all the same stuff, I promise. I might actually take one or two things off Patreon for a laugh every now and again and see if I'm not going to do that. I'm sorry to say that out loud. I'm not going to do that. Heaton's livid with me. Absolutely livid with me. I'm surprised he didn't throw something at me at that point. We're going to talk about the manager and the song. He gets to have his view, Josh, and he wants to conduct everyone. My general view on songs is I often can't be bothered. I like Colton annoys. He gets to have his view a little bit, and he's obviously a teeny little bit self-conscious, not least because I sort of feel a bit like he's probably his harshest judge of himself. Mm. And I think he also wants everyone to be behind the players, be behind the team. But, he's made his point, but people are going to sing what they're going to sing.
Yeah, I almost think around this, and I used to think it as well. And listen, there's ways in which you can use these things to motivate people. Like, we all loved that he effectively said to the players, I'm presuming it was him who said it anyway, like, you can't touch the Anfield sign until you've won something. It seemed like that was the sort of almost a rule that came from him and then spread throughout the team. And I quite like that because it meant that, when they did, we all got to buzz off the moment that they won the trophies and they got to touch the sign and all those kinds of things. But he always said that about his old songs as well, didn't he? He was always like, oh, don't sing until I've basically won something. And then when we did, that was also a nice moment. But now I'm almost like, just chill out a bit, Jürgen. Because it's like you say, like, us singing about Jürgen is contributing to the atmosphere. And yes, he might sort of look around and be like, oh, why are you not making a song for Big Dom yet? Or why have you not made a song for McAllister that you want to sort of sing in the ground yet? And sort of support the players more in that way. But we're just supporting the team, and Jürgen is a part of the team, and he sort of just needs to accept that and just get over it a little bit, I think.
My thing on the team part, Stu, Gutman hates the song, by the way. I've been having murder with him about it for about 12 months. But my point of Gutman's been, it is the only song we have which mentions winning the league in 2020. Yeah. We haven't got another song that mentions winning our first league in 30 years. And the reason why is because of COVID. That if COVID doesn't happen, we would end up with about five, and we would have got to have a season where we go to Goodison and we go to Old Trafford and we sing songs about the fact that we're champions, we won the league, we won it better than anyone else. And I'm not, like, the song in general, I always have a mixed view on the songs, but the reason why I always like it is at some point I'll go, oh yeah, we won the league. And if it does it help Jürgen, if he thinks of it about that, it's literally our only one that mentions winning the league genuinely. So there was a Mane one that mentioned winning the European Cup, and that comes up at different times, and we've won it in Madrid and all that sort of stuff in there. But it's our only one that mentions winning the league. And I'm a bit like, well, you know, unless someone wants to come up with another one, and I don't see how that happens now. It's this or nothing where we talk about the fact that we won the league. It was great winning the league. I want to win another one, don't get me wrong. But this is it. This is our one where we talk about winning the league. There's no others.
Yeah, I think he needs to relax about it. really. As you say, it's the only one there about, that talks about winning the league. And I think, you know, you go back to what football is as a fan, you know, at its very roots and its very core, it's about going and being with your mates and enjoying yourself and being happy and celebrating and just having a really good time. And I think he gets in his head a little bit about these types of things. As you said, I think he does like a cauldron of noise. I think he wants.
I love a cauldron of noise.
Yeah, I know, me too. And I think he wants it to be about the players as well. But I remember, I go back to what, you know, his early years, really, and I think it was after the Arsenal game where Mane scored on his debut. It was certainly early days where we'd had a two or three situations where players had ran to him, and like we conceded. Then afterwards, you know, we conceded a goal or two, and he made a point in a press conference where he said, like, I've told the players that they can't do it now. They can't come running to me when there's 20 minutes to go in a game and jumping on my back. You know, we can't be having piggybacks. It just sends us the wrong message. I think, you know, for us though, we love that.
Yeah.
You know, when I see that Mane goal, or I see the Lallana one as well at Norwich, and I see them running to their manager, I absolutely love that. I can't help but smile. It doesn't matter how many times I see it. I love that togetherness, that excitement, that almost like just lads on the schoolyard, almost, you know, just having a laugh together with it. I think it's what football support is at its very core. And I think, you know, with the competitive world of the Premier League where points are at stake and livelihoods are at stake, I think it's really sometimes easy to forget that. So I just think, you know, just relax a little bit, Jürgen, there. Don't worry about it. Let us sing our songs. We're only being sound. You know what I mean? Worry about it when we're calling for your head. Hopefully that'll never happen. And just worry about what's going on the pitch instead.
I was literally
going
to say that. I was just like, Brendan Rodgers is sitting there just saying, lad, you have no idea how you've got it.
Yeah.
But the other thing about this as well, I think, and it's really, I kind of see it whenever I'm sitting in the main stand and just in front of him. He gets wound up during the game so much by so many little things that he really doesn't need to. Yeah. But I think that's just who he is and the nature of who he is. And I think for him, it's like you say, the thing with the 20 minutes to go and conceding a goal, I think it's a superstition thing. I think even though we're not singing it because we think the game is over, in his mind, because he thinks it should be an end of the game song, he feels like it should be there. And so he, in his mind, he associates it with that, which is his fault, to be really honest. Like, he's the one who has to get over it in that respect. But I do also think, to a certain extent, the stuff that he says and does in the moment, because I think the shocking thing of listening to the clip of the audio is how annoyed he is and how much he goes in. And that's just his mode at that moment.
Yeah.
I think
it's like me on foul throws, what the ball boys are up to and whether or not the crowd's giving it up to the liner.
Well, exactly.
Like if people, someone mic'd me up for bits and pieces in the centenary, you'd be amazed what drives me mad.
Oh, yeah.
I honestly, I'm on some ball boys' backs there. They need to have a good long think about things.
The thing is, though, you know, something that we're forgetting as well is his missus loves the song, and she just might be singing it relentlessly in the kitchen all the time. Yeah. You know what I mean? It might just be that.
Shut up,
sing that song. Yeah, so it might just be that.
But like, I do, in all honesty, though, I think this might be one of those things where in the moment he was intense and angry, but now he's looking back and he's thinking it's a bit... Like, if he was knowing that we were, so many people were talking about him, he'd just like, oh, for fuck's sake.
Yeah, this now? Christ, stop filming me. Jesus. Okay, just dead quick. James Pearce says no, recognised holding midfielder. I'll tell you what, that gives everyone some wiggle room.
Yeah, I mean, we'll define recognised holding midfielder. They've been, you know, thin on the ground anyway, so...
Is it just we're not buying Rodri?
No, I think maybe this means that we're not buying Caicedo or Tchouaméni. It's one of those where it's like they're still looking at things, but you know, the fact that Bajcetic was back on the bench and then Endo came on and made it, like, it gives you more options in that, so you don't have to go, you absolutely need one guy whose only job is to do this. We now get some guys who can do some of this but could also do some other things.
That's my reading of it in reality. I mean, I still want them to buy three players. I suspect they may be disappointed, but I want them to get another couple of defenders. I mean, the manager, to be fair to him, he did find the only context in which I want to see Kostas Tsimikas come on at the minute. he managed to find literally the only one where I went, yep, fine with that, good decision. But I think Gravenberch and Decore links are persisting aggressively, Josh. Gravenberch coming on. Really quite strong indeed. I feel a bit like Munich have got a decision to make here. Gravenberch might have got a bit of a decision to make. Munich have got a decision to make. And then it looks like Liverpool and Manchester United might have a decision to make. But it feels like that's a live thing in European football.
Yeah, I just think there are two players who Liverpool almost have to wait for the opportunity to sign them now. I don't think Liverpool are sort of signing those players, as in I don't think they're signing them for the price that Crystal Palace have quoted. I think they probably want Crystal Palace to come down on that price for Decore, and Bayern ultimately need to want to sell Gravenberch. Otherwise, I don't see a way in which either of them move. And my opinion on the summer has been broadly the same. The idea of signing Caicedo was probably the one that sort of appeased me to be like, oh, we'll probably sign Andre in January now, and I'm happy to wait till January for Andre because we've got Caicedo in. I could see a world in which they almost do like a, not a pre-contract, because that's not really what it is, but we've signed Andre, but he's there until January. He's our player as of January. And the centre-back thing, I've loved seeing all the links and sort of living all the links. I just think Colwill was the one, and I've sort of always thought that. And I can see the argument of why Liverpool would have thought that. I'd have liked them not to have thought that. I'd have liked them to have thought some other lads were an option there. I just think that was always what it was. I think that was, we really like this lad. We think he might be available this summer. Suddenly he wasn't available this summer, and they've gone, Sam, what we have, we hold, which may well be Nat Phillips again.
I don't think it'd be Nat Phillips. I'm just more concerned. Not concerned, because he's obviously shown he's got a degree, a pedigree, but at some point, footballers like Matip go on the turn. Yeah. And I've long had an argument that no one goes off like a centre-half. Centre-halves turn like milk.
Well, I think the thing with Matip for me is just that we have to play so differently. So many players around him have to play differently when he's playing. And if we're trying to do this new thing and then we're all having to change, it's a bit of a halfway house.
Kevin Ratcliffe went overnight. Stefan Honcho went overnight. Sol Campbell went overnight. Centre-halves go overnight.
Rio. I remember Rio. It's went overnight. Horrific games at QPR.
It's a thing that happens. Centre-halves, when they go. That is my worry. What do you think we're going to do from here?
I'm worried about the defensive midfielder situation. I am worried about that. And, you know, I noticed then we continue to talk about Decore there, but are we not classifying him as a recognised holding midfielder?
I don't know.
I think all the London
media are saying Liverpool are really into Decore.
Yeah, but I think if what Pearce has got is right, then I think it's that rules him out to me, which I'm fine with if they've got the Andre deal locked down, because YouTubed him.
And
he looks boss, but he looks an angry little fella as well. You know what I mean? He looks like he's going to get around the pitch and have a bit of bite about him, but also I don't think we've got enough of them in the squad. I like an angry so-and-so. I like a Mascherano. And I'm not saying he's a Mascherano, but, you know, I like the look of him.
And I don't think they're going to do him, though, before January. If they remain in the Libertadores, I think they'll see it through.
That's fine. If that's the rationale for we're not getting another one because we've got him and he's the one we want, but we've got to wait till January and we're going to go with these lads till then fine. But I don't want to not have that information. I don't want to get to the end of the transfer window and it's not being said that that's what the move is. Mm-hmm. I'd like it wrapped up. Just it's a bed for everyone, I think. The one I don't get is the Gravenberch one. I don't get that because he's done bits of defensive midfielder. He can do a job there, but even the Bayern manager doesn't see him as a number six. So I'm thinking, okay, so is he then competition for the other two midfield positions? Well, the left side, you've already got Thiago. Okay, he's got a year to go, but you've bought in McAllister and you've got Jones. So if I was Jones and they brought him in for competition on that side, I'd have a bit of a problem with that, to be honest. And then on the right side, you've got, you know, the world's new greatest player, Szoboszlai. And then you've got Harvey Elliott as well.
And McAllister can do stuff over there. Mm-hmm. We've seen it in the past. Yeah.
So I'm just scratching my head a little bit about it. Unless they want to convert him to a number six, fine. But that will be a project. He can do it, but I don't think he brings all the elements that we want. I think he's great on the ball as a six, a ball playing six, a playmaker. But I don't think he's one who's, you know, snuffing stuff out everywhere all over the pitch, putting out fires. I'm not sure he's that. So I think there's a question there. I definitely think we need, as we've said all pre-season, we need left side of centre half, and we need, ideally, I wouldn't mind a right back as well for a bit of competition there for Trent. So I'd like three.
I'd like three from here as well. We'll see as the opportunities come. I'd like three agreed. I'm all right with one in January as well. Mm-hmm. If other bits are bedded down in there. I think it's going to be a crazy end to the window. Everything you need on transfers on the Anfield wrap, gutters practically fucking daily, to be honest with you. You know, which you might like, listeners. It's just, you know, I like to think there's a finite amount of Gutman you want in your lives, and yet here we find ourselves. It appears that your quantity of Gutman that you most desire
is... taking a spare room somewhere in Man Island.
Yes, is indeed infinite. Who knew? Thank you very much on this one to Josh Sexton, to Stu Wright, to Mo Stewart. Sam Walker-Dine has looked after the images, if you've enjoyed the YouTube of it. Andy Heaton has looked after the audio, which I'd like to think you've enjoyed all of, no matter which direction you've gone into. I tell you what, Liverpool, they're going to be a hell of a roller coaster all the way through this campaign. We should enjoy it together as far as we can and not lose our heads, and hope that they don't either. Sports Social Podcast Network.